Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to Psychiatric Pearls. My name is Paul Gleason. My guest today is Dr. Catherine Phillips. She is currently professor of psychiatry, DeWitt Wallace Senior Scholar, and Residency Research Director for the Department of Psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medicine. She is also an attending psychiatrist at New York Presbyterian Hospital and adjunct professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the Albert Medical School of Brown University. Dr. Phillips, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, within the field of psychiatry, one of your main areas of expertise is body dysmorphic disorder, or BDD. As our listeners may know, this is a mental health disorder in which you can't stop thinking about perceived defects or flaws in your appearance, flaws that are often minor or even invisible to others. This condition currently affects around 2 to 3% of the general population. So my first question for you, Dr. Phillips, is how and when did you become interested in BDD?
Well, I became interested in BDD when I was a resident, and I saw a few patients who were just obsessed with these perceived defects or flaws in their appearance, which I couldn't see. And these preoccupations with their appearance had really negatively impacted their life. And, you know, as an example, I remember, I think I was a PGY3 resident, outpatients, and one of these patients described his depression, his inability to work because he was so depressed, and his suicidality. And then, you know, he was leaving the session. I thought, this is major depressive disorder, severe. And he's leaving the session. His hand is on the doorknob, and he turns to me and said, "Should I tell you the real reason I'm here?" I said, yes, please do. Fortunately, I had an hour free. And he said, "This is so hard for me to talk about. I'm embarrassed, I'm ashamed, but it's because of my hair." And he had obsessions with hair loss. And of course, he had a full head of hair. But he said, this is why he was so depressed. This is what was making him feel life wasn't worth living. This is why he was unable to work. And I saw a few other patients like that. And I thought, what is this? I have not heard about this in medical school. I haven't heard about it in my residency. Now, you know, this was maybe around 1990. I knew that BDD was in DSM-3R, but again, I hadn't heard about it. So I went to the library because we didn't have the internet back then, didn't exist. And I was just amazed to find that cases of BDD had been described around the world for more than a century, although we were just really lacking good research studies, even of its clinical features and associated morbidity, and we had no treatment. And so I started telling supervisors and colleagues I was interested in seeing these patients, and they found them. They had these patients in their practice, and they didn't know it was BDD. BDD just wasn't on the map back then, but they had it, and they were so ill, and some of them were quite suicidal. And I just felt I had to figure out what this was all about.
You must have spent a lot of time in libraries, because in 1996, you published The Broken Mirror, Understanding and Treating Body Dysmorphic Disorder, which was, I believe, the first book published on the topic. Before this was published, how did the field of psychiatry generally understand and treat BDD?
I think it was usually missed. And I think because clinicians didn't ask about it, and patients were often too embarrassed and ashamed to reveal their concerns. You know, they're afraid that you're going to think that they're vain, or that they have a silly concern. Or if they mention it, you're gonna notice even more how bad they look. And of course they look normal, but they think they look ugly. I think it was misdiagnosed as all kinds of things. Schizophrenia, because they often have no insight. They're certain they look ugly. Misdiagnosed as OCD. Now it does overlap with OCD, but it has some differences, including poorer insight and more depression and more suicidality. It was misdiagnosed as depression. Well, they often do have depression too. Right. So I think it was either missed entirely because patients weren't talking about it and they weren't asked, or it was misdiagnosed as another disorder.
And with the book, what were you hoping to change about psychiatry's understanding of BDD?
Yeah, I just wanted to raise awareness. I felt, oh my gosh, this is, of all the patients I've seen over the decades, these are among the patients who suffer the most. It's often tormenting. Now, You know, I should mention there's a spectrum of, there's a range of severity in BDD. So there can be milder BDD, moderate BDD, severe BDD, but on average, it's a very distressing disorder. On average, they're quite impaired in their day-to-day functioning with poor quality of life, high rates of suicidality in this disorder. You know, maybe when compared to other psychiatric disorders, we think rates of suicidal ideation, suicide attempts, and probably completed suicide are higher than many other severe mental illnesses. So, you know, it's often a very, very, very severe condition. Fortunately, we have good treatments that we have figured out. So we need to know more about treatment, but we have good treatments now.
Yeah, and my next question was just about clinical practice and kind of what you were hoping to change in clinical practice. It sounds like one of the things you were hoping to change is just people recognizing it.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, through the research studies that I've done, and now there's so many more researchers in the field. It is really, in the 90s, there was almost no one. And then it's gradually increased. So now there are some great researchers around the world who are studying this disorder. So we've learned so much more about it. We now know it's more common than OCD. It's more common than schizophrenia. 2-3% of the population currently has BDD. We've learned about what are its clinical features? And that's where I started. What are the symptoms? And then I had to develop measures, you know, diagnostic and screening measures and severity measures to do studies, to do treatment studies. And for me, always as a clinician, I was also seeing patients through all those decades, and I still do, but finding treatment, because it's one thing to identify BDD, but then how do you help the patients? So that was always a quest of mine. So I've spent a lot of time writing grants and doing studies to try to, you know, shed some light on all of this.
And I mean, and even after that first book came out, there was obviously a lot more to say, because you've gone on to write and co-author a bunch of books on the topic, including, this was interesting to me, co-authoring a book on BDD among men. And so I was wondering if you could speak to what are some important similarities and differences in men and women with BDD, and in what ways may clinicians need to approach these two populations differently for treatment?
Right. I think the most important thing to recognize is that BDD is almost as common in men as it is in women. And I think sometimes people assume, oh, this is, you know, body image problems are women issues, you know, and that's not the case. So it's almost as common in men as it is in women. And the clinical features of BDD are really very similar between men and women, but there are a few interesting differences. So men, for example, are more likely to worry about thinning hair and going bald, whereas women are more likely to worry about excessive body or facial hair. Men are more likely to worry about their genitals, but I wonder if that's changing, and women are, I think, increasingly concerned about that. Maybe one of the major differences is that there is a form of BDD called muscle dysmorphia, which occurs almost exclusively in men. Now, they often have other more typical features of BDD, worrying about, you know, that they have scars on their skin or their, you know, nose is too big, but men with muscle dysmorphia worry that their body build isn't big and muscular enough. And I think this is a quite severe form of BDD. And a particular challenge is we've found that there are higher rates of substance abuse in men with muscle dysmorphia compared to men without muscle dysmorphia. And a big concern is use and abuse of anabolic steroids and all kinds of other muscle building, estrogen modulating, androgen modulating agents that people can now just buy online. And these are prescription and non-prescription drugs. And I've seen patients who've been using 50 of these kinds of things, and sometimes growth hormone and thyroid hormone and insulin and things like that, because they may be trying to achieve a lean, muscular look. But the anabolic steroid use is very concerning and can, you know, cause roid rage, which people have probably heard of, depression if you're stopping them, and have all kinds of medical problems associated with them. We also tend to see more substance abuse in men than in women with BDD, and women with BDD are more likely to have a comorbid eating disorder. So those are some of the differences, but many more similarities than differences between men and women with BDD.
Right. And I was wondering too, how the pandemic has been affecting people with BDD. What kind of new challenges might it raise for someone like that?
Yeah, I think it does come with challenges for many patients. I think one is that some, you know, if people are on video, you know, as they are during my appointments or at other times of the day, they can see themselves, at least on Zoom, which I use a lot of. And then, you know, common rituals of BDD are comparing with others, scrutinizing your appearance and looking for any little tiny perceived flaws. So I think seeing all the faces on Zoom, if there's a group and comparing, you know, they compare themselves to others and they always, of course, underestimate their own attractiveness. And BDD often involves the face or the head. So these close-up images of their own face can be quite distressing. And so I have to do a lot of work with helping patients not compare while they're on Zoom and not scrutinizing themselves. I think another challenge is some people during the pandemic are less busy, much harder to go out and do things. And so I think too much free time is really not good for people with BDD. I mean, I think it can make them more depressed. And also it just gives more time for their obsessions to flourish and for them to do rituals. So I think one challenge is how to get people with BDD to be active with healthy activities if they may not be able to go out much. And that can be a challenge, but we really want to stop the rituals. We really want to help them get out of their house or apartment, of course, in a careful way, taking all precautions with COVID, but we want to help them replace time spent on BDD preoccupations and rituals with healthy activities. You know, as part of our cognitive behavioral therapy, we do exposures, and that can be challenging during the pandemic with as it's more difficult to go outside and be around people. And then finally, I just want to mention that the stress that so many people experience with the pandemic, social isolation, financial stress, you know, perhaps loss of a loved one, I mean, or illness in yourself or others, that of course is something that people with BDD experience also. And I think stress can, for some people, make BDD symptoms even worse. So I think the pandemic can be challenging for people with BDD, as it is for pretty much everybody.
Yeah, it is challenging for all of us. Just popped into my head the issue of masks.
Yeah.
Do people tend to, many patients like the fact that they get to wear masks now? Or is it a problem because it kind of lets them feed into the idea that, oh, now I'm safe because nobody can see me?
Well, if they're worried about a part of the face that the mask covers, then they might feel it's a little bit easier to go out and be around people or go to the grocery store and do things. So it can make it a little bit easier for them to be around others, because people with BDD are generally very anxious around other people because they think other people are looking at them thinking they look ugly, even though they don't. But ultimately, we want people to stop using camouflage. There are many forms of camouflage in BDD, and the mask would be one of them, or a hat pulled down over your face, or sunglasses indoors or outdoors or that sort of thing. But ultimately, we want people to stop using the camouflage because we want them to not have to depend on it and to feel comfortable going out without hiding their body.
Right. Now, kind of broadening out from BDD for a minute, you know, I know you've also done work on trauma and PTSD with BDD. Why do you think there's a link between trauma and BDD, and how does that link affect treatment choice and prognosis?
Right. You know, there may be. We need more research on this topic, but there have been a few studies, you know, in which we have found that compared to norms, normative data, people with BDD have, you know, elevated rates of abuse and neglect. That's not specific to BDD. Of course, that's true for many other psychiatric disorders. Another study found that people with BDD are more likely to have a history of abuse or neglect compared to people with OCD. And recently, some colleagues and I published a paper on a large cohort of individuals with OCD and found that those who also had comorbid BDD were more likely to have had trauma in their life and had a probable PTSD diagnosis. And, you know, and yet other studies have shown people with BDD report higher rates of having been teased and bullied, you know, in their lives than other groups. And I think, you know, this makes sense. Of course, this is not the only thing that would contribute to the development of BDD, but I think, you know, if you've experienced trauma, if you've been abused, and especially I think if you've been criticized about your appearance or bullied about your appearance, and it kind of makes sense that that might increase your risk for developing BDD, that you might actually start thinking, oh, there is something wrong with me. Now, we know genetic factors are important in BDD as well, and there are other risk factors as well. Not everyone with BDD has a history of trauma, but I think there is a link there. And I think for some people, it makes a lot of sense. I often hear patients say, you know, they start off with, you know, I was called pygmy nose when I was bullied about my skin, you know, when I was a teenager. So we hear that from some patients. And it makes sense that that might trigger the development or the onset of BDD.
OCD. And I know that you're also involved with the International Accreditation Task Force of the Canadian Institute for OCD. I was wondering, you know, what's the goal of the task force? And if you can, you know, tell us some of the findings so far.
Well, the Canadian Institute for Obsessive Compulsive Disorders is an international organization. It's a wonderful group. And the mission of this group is to really improve the treatment OCD and related disorders like BDD around the world. You know, we have practice guidelines for OCD, certainly. I publish a lot on how to treat BDD, but we need better dissemination of this evidence and better implementation. And so the task force has members from 14 nations, and we've recently developed knowledge and competency standards, specialized treatment of OCD. We're starting with OCD and sort of what clinicians really need to know. And they're just being published now. It's a series of 5 papers. And then the group will move on to developing and implementing criteria and processes for training clinicians and accreditation and in treating OCD and related disorders. So we're starting with OCD and then we'll move on to other disorders. I hope BDD is next, actually.
Yeah, speaking of, you know, kind of what the kind of future research is going to show and what the future holds, what do you think the future has in store for prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of BDD?
We need to make progress on all of these fronts. We've learned so much over the past decades, but BDD is much less studied than other severe mental disorders. We need so much more research, you know, on all aspects of BDD. I think especially suicidality, treatment of BDD in young people. BDD, in 2/3 of cases, it begins during childhood or adolescence, before age 18. And there's just a paucity of research studies in younger people. We know SRIs work. We often need higher doses than we use for other disorders. It's much like the treatment of OCD in that way. We often have to exceed the FDA maximum dose of the SRIs. I don't do that for clomipramine. I don't do that for citalopram, but we often have to go to higher doses. They often work well, very well. But, you know, we need more research on augmentation strategies. So we have very little data. I find clinically adding an atypical neuroleptic, I especially am a fan of aripiprazole to an SRI, can be very helpful if an SRI alone isn't enough. I'm increasingly using some glutamate modulators and acetylcysteine, memantine in addition with an SRI. Buspirone, it's an old standby, I find sometimes can be quite helpful when added to an SRI. But most of these studies are in adults, and actually we have very little data on the augmentation strategies or other classes of medication. So we really need more treatment research. And then prevention, that's the final frontier. I think we definitely need to work on how do we prevent BDD. You know, we need to get programs, ideally get programs into schools to help people develop healthy body image, to help people realize that other things matter about you, not just how you look, but to broaden people's and young people's sense of self-esteem, for example. So it's not so narrowly focused on appearance. And, you know, there's work being done to try and decrease bullying on social media and in schools. And I think all that's potentially relevant to BDD, because it may play a role, you know, in people who are at risk for developing BDD. Those kinds of experiences may be an additional risk factor for BDD.
So it sounds like back in the 90s, we knew very little. Now we know more, but there is, again, much more to find out. If our listeners would like to learn more about BDD, where would you send them first? What's a really good resource or two that you think people would really benefit from checking out?
Well, if you subscribe to UpToDate, I write the BDD section and has good information about BDD. It's about to be updated soon. I published a textbook on BDD. It's for clinicians a couple years ago. It's still quite up to date. It's published by Oxford University Press. The International OCD Foundation has information on BDD on their website. But, you know, go on to PubMed and Google BDD and, you know, you'll find an increasing number of, you know, well-done research studies, really from researchers around the world on the prevalence of BDD, the genetics of BDD, suicidality, cosmetic treatment. I don't know that I've said much about that, but we don't want these patients to get cosmetic treatment. They often want it. They often get it. And it seems not to be effective. We really want to give them pharmacotherapy that I've talked about, usually starting with an SRI, often needing pretty high doses. And, you know, you may want to check EKGs, depending on the med and the dose along the way, and cognitive behavioral therapy. Colleagues and I have developed a cognitive behavioral therapy and tested that. That can be very helpful. It has to be tailored specifically to BDD. But I should mention there are two evidence-based CBT treatment manuals for clinicians that are available on Amazon, one by Sabina Wilhelm, myself, and Gail Steckity. And that treatment manual has been tested in studies that have been published, and also treatment manual by David Veal and Fugan Nezaroglu. So for psychiatrists with CBT training, you know, I do recommend use of a manual. I think BDD is hard to treat without a treatment manual. It's a little tricky. And some of these patients are, you know, high risk patients, but those resources are available. Wanted to be sure to mention that.
I hope our listeners will check them out. And thank you so much, Dr. Phillips, for coming on today.
Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to Psychiatric Pearls. You can find more of our conversations on the Psychiatric Times website and on iTunes. If you listen to us on iTunes, please remember to subscribe and rate us.